Imagine paying $100,000 a year just to insure your house. That is the reality facing some homeowners in the near future, according to a climate economist. Belinda Story from Climate Sigma says those are the sorts of costs an owner of a $1 million home on the Potone foreshore in Lower Hutt could be facing in just 20 years' time. Belinda Story is with us now. Good morning, Belinda.
Morena.
Okay, that is a worst-case scenario, is it? That is if we did nothing at Potone to try and mitigate the sinking land and flooding.
That's correct. So that is the subsidy that would be required to continue to provide insurance in that location if you didn't invest significantly in seawalls and pumps.
That's interesting you mentioned subsidy. So there would be a cross-subsidy though, right? There'd be some areas where there is very low risk and that gets mixed up. The insurance companies presumably, you know, smooth that out.
Yes, but no insurance company is going to continue to provide insurance once you're reaching that sort of level. So the research that I've previously done indicates that they'll pull out when the probability is only 5% a year, not 70% a year. So the insurers are likely to have withdrawn insurance well before you reach that level. But given that the government is considering bringing in a public insurer to cover climate risks, there is a very real chance that the government could end up paying those subsidies on those houses.
Mm. Where do the banks fit into all of this and mortgages and their assurances that they're going to want?
So once a house loses insurance, it falls into technical default. And a bank is very unlikely to call in default at that point. Instead, what they're likely to do is increase interest rates. So interest rates are rising anyway at the moment. But if you are in a situation where a private insurer isn't going to insure you, then it's likely that the bank will want to cover that risk by significantly increasing the interest rate on your mortgage.
Mm. What you're signalling here is managed retreat, right, but driven by the market and market forces. And what you've alluded to is that the government has signalled it's having a look at whether it would step in to assist those sort of caught in the middle. You don't think that's a good idea because what, you end up just perpetuating building on land that you shouldn't be?
And you end up risking people's lives. So if you subsidise people to remain in harm's way, then you will end up with people in an emergency who haven't evacuated and are facing a risk to their life. This is exactly what's happened in the States. So the state brought in a national flood insurance program in the 1960s in response to a major hurricane. It was hoped that it would help people in the and that it would only be short term. It's still around. You've got houses there that have been rebuilt 40 times. The same house being rebuilt 40 times because of repeat flooding. And it subsidised people to remain in harm's way, including people who live in the Ninth Ward in New Orleans. So part of the reason, the motivation for bringing that insurance was a devastating hurricane that occurred in New Orleans. 40 years later, it resulted in mass fatalities.
So what should happen for those people living there now who are thinking about this, have woken up to this morning, they would have been thrilled about hearing this. What happens to them? I mean, are they eligible for some sort of assistance from the government to move as sort of the foreshore moves backwards? What do you do?
So we need to address the question of managed retreat. The adaptation plan indicated that was something that the government was going to work on, but I think we need to be coming up with much more concrete answers for people. The government is going to have to step in at some point. The question is, do they step in with a whole lot of money or do they step in after there's a disaster, in which case there's even more money and lives have potentially been at risk?
Mm. I mean, first things first, you would need to establish whether there can be flood protections.
Flood protection also encourages the people to stay in harm's way. So that,
well, not if they're being protected, if the flood protections work.
So what we find is that if you put a levee or a stop bank or a seawall in place, people build more assets behind that wall. And because they feel safe, you end up with more assets and more people in harm's way. And seawalls are only a temporary measure. The sea is going to continue rising. Our storms are going to continue to get more intense. Walls don't provide protection. They provide temporary defence.
Right. So how quickly are we talking here that do these decisions need to be made?
These decisions need to be made immediately for any new development. We need to be having a meaningful conversation about funding. And there is an opportunity to have a transition. There is an opportunity to start to make these very difficult decisions now and move people out of harm's way in the next 10, 20 years. So we do have time to do that. But if you bring in maladaptation, if you bring in decisions that reinforce people to stay in harm's way, you'll make it even more difficult. If you put a whole bunch of money into seawalls or you put a whole bunch of money into a public subsidy, it's going to be even harder and more people to move out of harm's way when that disaster strikes.
Understand. Belinda, thank you very much for that. Belinda Story there with some sobering thoughts on climate change and the impact on those living on the foreshore in places like Petone and the skyrocketing insurance bills that they may face over the next 20 years or so. Some big decisions to be made.